Welcome back to The Peripheral. First things first, the Patreon is back up and going. Thank you all for donating to me. It's very nice, and you make this podcast ad-free. At one point, I'd reached out to a few therapy advertisers, but all of them wanted me to sign contracts. None of them would do a one-off here and there, so I just said, forget it. I got Patreon. Nobody's got time to listen to ads. Since the last episode, I've started using minoxidil on my receding hairline. So thank you, Blue, for the pro tips. I'm definitely using them. On this episode, I speak to Steven from the podcast This Is Adulting. It's about suicide. Steven asked me to give a warning at the beginning of the show about wrist cutting. He actually shares a story about his girlfriend that bothered me more than his actual description of his attempt. So just wanted to put that out there. I know this can be a dark topic for some. I promise you that I have a bunch more lighthearted episodes coming up to mix it up with some of these more dark episodes. So I promise you there is light. Introduce yourself along with your podcast.
Sure. My name is Steven. I never know what to say when I'm told to introduce myself. I am, I live in North Carolina. It's mm-hmm. about as far as I'll go.
No problem.
I am the co-host and founder of the Is This Adulting podcast, which is a podcast I do with my college roommate, which is combinations of silly and serious. All in the effort of breaking the stigma on mental illness. So
you start out every episode with a health check.
Yes, absolutely. We especially as we've both gotten into therapy and things like that now, both my co-host and I deal with mental illness. And so we figured a long time ago, you know, we were having these conversations anyway, which we were checking in on each other, making sure, you know, he struggles with anxiety. I struggle with a cocktail of things that I will share. But we decided, hey, you know, we're checking in with each other anyway, and then we're devolving into these stupid, silly, fun conversations. Like, why don't we just record this and make an effort to really connect with listeners and really be relatable and really be a resource so that we can say, hey, mental illness is a thing. It's a very real thing, and it's something that we struggle with, and we know that a lot of you struggle with too, so maybe we can all help each other.
Yeah, you're trying to be as real as possible.
Oh. Right, exactly. We approach it from a standpoint of this is something we just deal with, and that doesn't mean we can't have fun and be silly and talk about Star Wars, but that also means, you know, sometimes we got to get serious and talk about real stuff.
Yeah. I think it's a perfect combination and balance, because the fun stuff is what you distract yourself with. The fun stuff is what keeps you going.
Right. It's the old adage of, you know, if you don't laugh, you'll cry.
Exactly. Like,
you
know,
you got to find the laughter and the levity in everything.
Mm-hmm. So you had something happen when you were in high school?
Yes. That is kind of where this all begins. Mm-hmm. I guess technically the anxiety that I've struggled with, that's mental illness number one. I have a chronic panic disorder. That kind of started when I was younger. When I was 5, I apparently told my mother it felt like there were wheels turning inside me that never stopped.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know how, as a 5-year-old, I was that in tune with my body or my brain, but I told her that, and, you know, that could very well be the ADHD too. There's number two. Even though that's more of a disorder than an illness, but it all kind of started there. But once I hit high school, the mental illness monster, as we kind of call it on our show sometimes, kind of reared its ugly head. And, that all stemmed from this kind of traumatic event that I went through. I was 16 years old, mm-hmm. and I had a girlfriend who we had dated for about a year, year and a half, which in high school is, you know, a lifetime.
Yeah.
And we we were being high schoolers. We were doing what high schoolers do. We were horsing around and roughhousing and playing. And she was chasing me around her driveway. And I ran back in through the door. She was in a split level house. And so there was a door into the living room off of the driveway, kind of down on the lower level. And so I ran into there and she was right behind me. And so, you know, we're messing around. So I turned and I closed the door behind me. Now, what didn't happen is I tripped and fell and used the door to break my fall and it shut behind me. That's the lie I told myself, and that's the lie I told people when I told this story for years. Mm-hmm. Because I couldn't come to terms with I made the decision to shut the door.
Yeah.
But when I did, she reached out to stop it. And it was a standard door leading into a house, but, you know, it had a window in it. And her arm went straight through the window and shattered the glass. So, of course, at first, you know, we're freaking out because I'm thinking, okay, well, her mom's going to kick my ass.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to have to figure out how to fix this. And then I realized she's not laughing with me and she's not panicking about it. And she just screamed and took her, I don't know how graphic I can get, took her hand off of her, you know, upper forearm around the wrist, and I saw bone.
Ouch.
And all of a sudden I realized there was blood spraying on the walls and on me. And so she ran upstairs. Her mom's a nurse, luckily, so she kind of knew what to do. She jumped into action. I called 911, which is the only time I've ever had to do that in my life, thank God. I still to this day can't listen to a podcast that play too many 911 calls, though, just because it kind of freaks me out. Mm-hmm. But I called 911, and then I just remember going out into the driveway and just like collapsing between the four cars that were parked there and just like sitting there and rocking back and forth and not really knowing what to do. I went into shock. Luckily, the fire department was in her backyard, literally. Mm-hmm. So they got there and stopped the bleeding initially, and then the paramedics came, but I could not ride in the ambulance, so I got in my car to drive myself, which her neighbor, who also happened to be the same year as me in high school, and a good friend of mine, immediately jumped in the car and took my keys and said, no, like, you're not in any condition to drive. So she drove me to the hospital, and I spent the next probably 12 hours at the hospital, sitting in the emergency room. They let me go back, but sitting outside the room while they worked on her. And what had happened was there was glass in there they had to get out, but the bleeding had stopped for the most part when the fire department came the first time. But since it had stopped without the removal of the glass, they had to reopen the wound. In the end, what happened is her ulnar artery was severed 90%. If it had been 100%, she would not have made it. I sat up most of the night while they did microscopic surgery. They got her put back together, and I was still in complete shock. You know, I went back to her house and cleaned up as much as I could. A friend came and picked me up at the hospital, and we did that. And I actually went into work and almost lost my job because I went in and screamed at my boss. Because when I initially called in, he told me I was making it up, and if I didn't show up, I was fired.
Oh, God.
So I went in wearing a blood-soaked T-shirt, and I threw it on his desk. And I asked him if he fucking believed me now, and I stormed out. I was lucky enough that the general manager of the store I was working at did not fire me over that, and he actually reprimanded the assistant manager for being such a jerk about it.
You're calling into work. It's not the end of the world. They can get by without you.
Right, exactly. And it's a grocery store. You know, it's not gonna, you know, they have a lot of employees. It's not like there's three employees and I'm calling out and I was the only person they had.
So this weighs heavy on you because you're blaming yourself for almost killing your girlfriend.
Right. I remember the day after I didn't go to school and I just went into the hospital and I climbed into the hospital bed with her and I just cried. Because I realized I had almost killed her, or, well, she had almost died because of an accident. But at the time, I was very much in the mindset that this was my fault and I had almost done it. And That's why I lied to myself for years and told myself, oh, well, I tried to catch the door to break my fall. I tried to this, I tried to that. But the fact of the matter is I made a choice. We thought we were just playing around, and it caused an accident that very nearly cost her life. And it took me a long time to come to terms with that. I was lucky enough in high school to have some teachers who, the day I did go back, I had a handwritten note from my mother signed by a doctor saying, like, hey, don't push him. Like, as far as schoolwork, just kind of let him be present. He needs a couple days. Like I said, I went into shock. I remember in the emergency room, they were trying to give me the same sedatives they were giving her, because I was just, I was a mess.
Well, it's understandable. I don't blame your reaction at all. I mean, it's, you're in love with this person, and it was such a simple, innocent mistake. It makes you feel like life is truly fragile. Our mortality is just hanging.
It definitely makes you feel that. And I, about a week later, had my first panic attack. Didn't know what one of those was like, but I sure found out.
Yeah, you think you're dying. They're not.
Yeah, I thought I was having a heart attack in high school at 17 years old. And, you know, I was a fat kid. You know, I have no shame in that. And I have no shame in using the word fat. I think it's too often given this negative connotation. You know, I was fat. I was like 300 pounds in high school. I thought I was having a heart attack, because heart disease runs in my family. And I thought for sure that was what was going on. And luckily it was not. And I talked to a doctor and checked me out, and they said, no, it's not your heart. I think you are having some sort of trauma-related anxiety. Mm-hmm. That was when I figured out that I had an anxiety disorder, and that would only worsen over the next 10 years.
Yeah, because you aren't doing anything about it. You're not treating it. You let it go unchecked, and it's just going to get worse.
Right. Well, for years, I was told by society, I was told by people that if I took medicine or if I sought therapy, then I was quote unquote crazy, and that it was something to be ashamed of.
You're weak. Yeah,
exactly. I can't handle my own pain. You know, as a 16, 17 year old kid, you believe that because you've never been told otherwise. You know, you believe that, yeah, okay, maybe I am weak if I give in to this. And plus, you know, at 17, you don't really want to start a whole bunch of medications. There's a reason that on the commercials it says, you know, it increases the risk of suicide in teens and young adults because your brain's not fully formed.
Yeah.
The chemicals are affecting you in a different way. So I really didn't want to go that route either. So I just kind of let it lay. And that was a big mistake.
And that sucks, because I think it's slightly more acceptable now. It's more in the public spotlight now.
Right.
I see younger kids talk about going to their therapist fairly openly, but that just might be the ones that I'm around, and it doesn't mean that it's true for all of them. And I mean, at least with parents, we think, oh, your kid's going to therapy, good, you know, he's working things right out. But other kids, they're vicious.
Kids are brutal, man.
Yeah. You know, so you go for 10 years of anxiety, panic attacks. Any milestones during that? Or,
well, I didn't make it out of high school before the next quote unquote milestone. Wasn't a good milestone. I was probably 17 the first time I considered and did what I consider an attempt as far as suicide goes. I've said in the past, you know, some people don't consider what happened to me an attempt, but I do. I consider myself someone who survived an attempt, because I came closer than a lot of people come to making good on that terrible thought. And so I remember we were at our house. This was right before my family entered some financial strife and we lost our home, and a lot of bad shit happened. But the one thing is, our family was always tight. Our family was always solid. You know, we had it out, but that was the one thing I was lucky to have, was a strong, supportive family. It was just my mom and my dad and me. And so that was good. But we got into our tussles. And I remember one night, my dad and I really got into it. You know, I was still dealing with all this stuff. I was still under a lot of pressure. I had this underlying mental illness, this depression that I didn't know about at the time. And I remember storming around to my room, and he was trying to come after me, and we were talking. I slammed the door and locked the door. And when I slammed the door, the big, tall, standing lamp that you can get for like $8 at Target, like one of those things, fell over, and it busted the bulb, and it shattered. I just remember my dad, who, very, very sweet man, would never hurt a fly, but he was angry. He wanted to talk, and I was shutting him out. And so he's beating on my door, and I remember just like kneeling down in front of this broken bulb, and there's this long shard of bulb glass sitting there. And that's the first time that the thought crossed my mind of, well, there is one way out of all this. And I took the glass and I held it in my hand for a while. And I think, you know, my dad finally decided, you know, he was going to give me some time to process. I think if he had had any clue what was going on the other side of that door, he would not have done so. But I sat there for a while, and I finally just decided, you know, maybe this was what I needed to do. And so I put the glass to my wrist, and I held it there, and I pressed it with pressure enough that, you know, I drew a little blood, and I stopped. I didn't go through with it. I stopped the moment I saw the blood. I think it became real. Some people don't consider that a suicide attempt. Some people will tell me that I did not attempt suicide. I believe that if you hold a razor to your wrist, just because you don't draw it across all the way doesn't mean you didn't attempt. You had the intent. I had the intent. I just, thank God, came to my senses.
Well, if you'd pressed it in another place, you could have hit the vein.
Exactly.
And would people have said, oh, well, that's an attempt? Well, I don't get the whole what's an attempt and what's not. If you have the thought and you're going through the motions, I would call that an attempt myself.
Exactly. And, you know, some people who have survived attempts, they get very touchy about what's an attempt and what's not. But the majority of them do understand. And they sit there and go, okay. Well, if you were doing it with the intent of actually going through with the action, okay, you attempted suicide, which makes you a survivor.
Yeah. Oddly enough, I've had other people tell me that they've overdosed on pills, and then in the same sentence say, but I really didn't want to die. But they went further down that path than most. So so they don't consider it an attempt, yet if they didn't get medical help immediately, they would have died. So I think that's a fuzzy, stupid argument to have with, I think if you're thinking about it and going through the motions, that's an attempt, and I don't care how far you got.
That kind of happened, and
I got a couple questions about this, if you don't mind. Some people say that suicide is a selfish act.
I think a lot of people who say suicide is a selfish act don't understand mental illness. I think that, but on the flip side as well, I think that people who say that it's all about the people surrounding the individual, I think that that's bullshit too. I don't think it is a selfish act, because in that moment, your brain is not firing rationally. You are not making this decision of, oh, well, this will all be better for me, and I don't care what happens to the other people. You know, I mean, that's what stopped me, is thinking about the other people. But that doesn't mean that if I'd gone through with it, I was being selfish. What people don't understand is depression, especially mixed with anxiety and other mental illnesses. I mean, people say, well, why don't you just cheer up? Why don't you just not feel that way? Okay, well, depression is the sadness, I guess, is the common cold. Mm-hmm. Depression is cancer. There's a difference. And I may catch some heat for this because people don't like when it's referred to this way, but depression is a terminal illness if not treated. The facts are 1 in 5 people who live with a serious diagnosable mental illness will commit suicide over the course of their life. 1 in 5. That's a radical number. If you really think about it, 20% is a high percentage of people. I mean, that's 1 out of 5 too many. And so
if you thought a disease was a 20% fatality rate, they would be looking for a cure for that disease real quick. It would be called,
right. Right. But because you can't see this illness as outwardly, or people are good at hiding it or whatever, it's become this stigmatized idea of, oh, well, that person's weak, or that person is, to answer your question, selfish. People see it as an act that somebody is making a very rational, conscious decision to do. And that's just not the case. I mean, there are people who just decide, with no underlying mental illness, there are people out there who just decide to kill themselves. Yeah. I'm not saying that's selfish either, but what I'm saying is, from a personal standpoint and from friends of mine, looking back at it, I don't see suicide as selfish, because I see it as a sick person, a person who is dealing with illness. And this is just one of the sad side effects.
Yeah. And when you said your brain is going against everything it's programmed to do.
Right.
We're hardwired for self-preservation. And you're throwing out a millennia of instinctual imprinted behavior when you do that.
You know, that's one reason my wife and I were having a discussion about suicide, actually, which sounds really depressing. But it was a conversation based off of the 8-year-old boy here in the past few days that committed suicide because of bullying, mm-hmm. who hanged himself. We were having a discussion on that because suicide in general goes against everything that your body is telling you to do. But some methods, my method, if I had gone through with it, gun method, pill method, they're fast or they're fairly painless, depending on if they're executed properly. But that doesn't mean that it's not going against every instinct you have. It's just the way your brain is firing at the time. I don't know if I've kind of rambled off and I'm not making sense.
No, you are clear as a crystal right now.
Okay. Cause I was going to say, cause to me, I've never bought the argument that suicide is selfish, and that's a lie. As I said it, I realized it's a lie. I have in the past thought that, mm-hmm. but as I've gotten older and as I've understood mental illness better and I've fought to break the stigma, I understand that this is a war, and people don't understand that every single day that you deal with a legitimate, and I say legitimate because there are people out there, not many, but there are people out there who do not have diagnosable disorders that blame a lot of things on disorders. But if you have a legitimate mental illness, it's a war. Every day is a war. And I know people think that that's just people being weak, but it's true. I know of a person who was a part of the community. She started the semicolon movement, if you've heard of that.
Yeah.
And she, while it started as a Christian organization, and I don't necessarily always jive with that whole idea of it, she was changing people's lives. She was telling them that just because you've attempted suicide, that's not the end of your story. Your story's going on. You're strong. You fight every day. But it's a battle you could lose any day. And unfortunately, about 2 months ago, I think, maybe even less time, she committed suicide after all these years of advocating against it, because every day is a struggle. You know, I don't mean to be a downer or make it sound like super sad. It's just a very serious issue that I think a lot of people put too much credence in the fact that it's a decision and it's not a symptom of an illness.
It goes with every day is a new day, but every day you kind of start over. I mean, you can make headway, you can win some battles, but the war's not over. Ever.
Right. You know, you don't cure yourself of depression. You learn to manage it. Mm-hmm. And that's something I've had to do, because my story goes on. And as it got worse and worse, managing was something that I finally decided to do, because it kept piling on over the years. You know, once I got to college, it escalated. Mm-hmm. And suicide crossed my mind a lot more, and the depression worsened. And the anxiety worsened, and that was triggered by a few things. And it can snowball, yeah. Especially if it's not treated.
And even if you're doing well, life is still happening. You can lose your job, break up with your girlfriend. You can have other things that will trigger you, or other setbacks that will absolutely demolish any headway you've made. And
right.
I remember one of my earlier episodes, she was talking about she was sad, and then that turned into depression. And then 10 years later down the road, she's like, oh my gosh, I thought I was mourning, but now I realize I am in a full-blown depression.
And it piles on, man. I'm telling you, it snowballs in a way that nobody really can understand unless they've seen it firsthand, I think.
Mm-hmm. Something happened a few years ago with your father?
Well, a few years ago and fairly recently. In 2011, I was a, junior or first-year senior in college. Mm-hmm. Over the summer, you know, my dad hadn't been feeling great, and so they said, okay, well, we're just going to run a stress test as a precaution, you know, make sure everything's good. But, you know, he had a heart cath 10 years ago. He's perfectly fine. Like, I mean, there was no blockage 10 years ago. There's no way that you can have significant blockage over those 10 years based on the way he had been treating his body. And so there's nothing to worry about. Well, quickly the stress test turned into, well, let's do a heart cath. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, okay, well, something's up. Against what everyone was telling me of everything's fine, don't worry about it, I drove the hour and a half or 2 hours home from school and skipped all my classes. Luckily, it was summer classes, and it was like racquetball, so it didn't matter. So, because he told me, he said, Steven, it's a fucking racquetball class. Like, you're not going to fail. Go do what you got to do. And so I went down for the heart cath just to be a support there. And what I didn't tell you is my father had diabetes and he did not watch his sugar ever, ever, ever. 10 years go by. And in a normal person, maybe they couldn't form that much blockage. Maybe he would have still been clean as a whistle. But in a diabetic, it can wreak havoc on your organs. It attacks your organs if you don't maintain it. And one of the first organs it attacks is your heart. And so I remember sitting in the waiting room after the cath, and my mom picks up the little waiting room phone, and we're all thinking everything's going to be fine. And I just kind of see her face shift, and I realize, you know, maybe everything's not going to be great. And I'm a 21, 22-year-old kid at the time. And she says, you know, there's some blockage. They're going to have to do open heart surgery. I say, okay, you know, then we talk to the cardiologist and realize, you know, my father wasn't years away. He wasn't weeks away, months away. He was literally days away from a massive fatal heart attack, anything strenuous. And that would have been it.
Wow.
He was actually supposed to be a pallbearer the week before. And I stepped in for him because he wasn't looking so good. Mm-hmm. And so I actually feel like that may have been a good move, you know?
Yeah. You might have saved his life at that moment.
Yeah, exactly. And so they went through with it. They did the open heart surgery. That's tough for a 21-year-old to have to, you know, have everybody step out of the room except for you and your dad and have him tell you to take care of your mom and all that if things go south with the surgery, because, you know, there was blockage in four arteries, but he could only have three operated on because the diabetes had dissolved his fourth artery. Sure, you know, great. We'll get the triple bypass. We'll see what happens. He pulled through. It was a long road to recovery. It was the first time I saw my father deal with mental illness. I knew he had diagnosed severe obsessive compulsive disorder with anxiety, but I had never seen him deal with depression until then. Mm-hmm. He entered full-on depression during his recovery, and I entered full on anxiety. I thought for sure every time I went to wing night, you know, at the restaurant up the street and had three beers and all the chicken wings I could eat, that was my last meal. I thought everything was going to be the thing that caused my heart attack, because my grandfather died at 42 years old of a massive heart attack.
Wow.
That's young. My father had just had heart surgery at 57, and would have had a massive heart attack. His twin brother had already had three heart attacks. And so in my head, you know, that's weighing on me now of, okay, well, it's going to be the heart. The heart's going to be the thing that gets me. And when you have an anxiety disorder, you constantly obsess about it. That triggered that.
Yeah. I'm sure some people would say, well, if you're so worried about it, why are you having three beers and a bunch of wings? But that's the other side of it, is food makes you happy.
And which I actually did after all that happened. I ran 5 miles a day. I never ramped up to it. I never did it the healthy way. I ran 5 miles a day, day one. I did it 7 days a week, every day for over a year. Mm-hmm. I barely ate. Yeah. What I did eat was good, with the occasional visit to the fast food, because I am in college after all.
It's got to happen.
But, oh, yeah, aside from, you know, some beers and the occasional fast food, I ate well, and I dropped 100 pounds in a year. And I was down to a, not slim, but for me slim, like 180, but I'm short, so it was still above the weight that I needed to be.
Yeah.
But I was able to drop that weight, and I got healthy because what I saw scared me. And the anxiety was fine until I graduated college and moved down to my first job and had another massive panic attack, something relating to my heart. I freaked out. And that's when I had my first encounter with medication, which was not a positive one for me. I went into the doctor with a panic attack, and she handled both my panic attack and my blood pressure, because apparently when I went in, both due to genetics and anxiety, my blood pressure was 168 over 119, but, which is stroke level.
Yeah, but white coat syndrome, panicking.
Right. Right, exactly. And I thought that for a while. But, I mean, most of my family starts blood pressure meds when they're 18. So we did reassess that later once I had handled some of that. And it was an actual blood pressure issue. But at the time, the biggest thing was the anxiety. So she prescribed everybody's favorite drug of choice, Prozac. I spent the next 2.5 years in a haze. I did not understand what was going on around me sometimes. Everything felt like a dream, and which pisses me off because I feel like I lost 2.5 years of my life. You know, I got married during that 2.5 years, and I barely remember a lot of it because it feels like a dream, which sucks. But at the same time, it was necessary at the time.
Well, it does suck because this is your honeymoon period, and it's you completely missed it. That's supposed to be the happiest time of your marriage, and you were a zombie.
Right. And so I went on to the normal thing you do once you get back from your honeymoon, minus the fact that on the last day of our honeymoon, my mother called me. Well, I called her to wish her a happy Mother's Day. And she responded that my grandfather had died that morning. And so we had been lucky enough to basically have been gifted a honeymoon in Hawaii because we're broke and we were just going to go to the mountains of North Carolina. But we had some very generous people pay for airfare and hotels, and all we had to pay for was food. Mm-hmm. And so I'm however many thousand miles away, and finally got back, dealt with that, went on doing the daily grind, got my corporate job, worked in my cubicle, took my Prozac like a good little zombie. And I'm not, you know, it works great for some people. It just didn't work for me.
Yeah, I want everyone to really let that sink in. You know, some people, they go to therapy and it doesn't work out. Some people take this medicine, it doesn't work out. You have to find what works for you, and it's different for everyone. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And I mean, the journey to find the right med for me, just because it was kind of a turbulent one. They upped my dose because I was having more anxiety. And about 2 weeks into the upped dose, I woke up one morning, and that was the day the pill told me, today's the day you kill yourself. Oh, man. I luckily had, this sounds terrible, but I consider myself lucky to have experienced the suicidal issues in the past without medication.
Yeah.
So as soon as I woke up, I knew what those thoughts were, and I knew that they weren't coming from me, because I knew the difference of suicidal thoughts because I'm depressed and suicidal thoughts that were coming from nowhere. And so that's why I say the pill told me to kill myself, because I believe the pill did tell me to kill myself. It was an imbalance in my brain, and I called into work and I made sure that I was with somebody all day that day. And I called my doctor and I said, I'm quitting cold turkey. I'm done with this. Mm-hmm. We will treat it naturally for now. I'll diet, exercise, I'll do all that good stuff. But I'm not doing this anymore because I'm on the wrong medicine.
Yeah. And it sucks because you shouldn't quit cold turkey, but you know that if you don't, you're going to have these thoughts over and over and over. It's just going to make you're going to double down on what's bad already. You know?
And with the medicine, it wasn't like before where there was some part of my mind telling me like, okay, well, think about it. With the medicine, it was just, oh, well, this is what we're doing today. And it was a terrifying, terrifying moment. I didn't want to feel that. So I quit cold turkey. Did go through some withdrawals because I'd been on it for 2.5 years. At the end of the day, it's worth it because I'm still sitting here talking to you. I handled it for as long as I could. And all was well. I was running again. You know, I had a job doing some communications for a nonprofit, and I was rolling on. Things were good. The job just started wearing me down again, and the job brought back that depression. It doesn't take much for somebody with a mental illness to really bring it back. Mm-hmm. The job brought back the depression, the lack of purpose, the lack of motivation, the anxiety ramped up because, you know, it felt like a storm was coming. And so I quit my job and I decided I was going to figure something out. And so that gave me time. I worked on myself. I started running. I started eating better again. I started dropping weight again because I had gained about 60 pounds back. Mm-hmm. I got off of the elliptical December 31st of this past year. Okay. 10:04 in the morning. I was getting ready to do some weights in my room. My wife got on the elliptical behind me, and my phone rings. The first thing out of my mom's mouth is, "I need you to stay calm." And which I just want to say, don't ever say that to somebody when they pick up the phone, because their first reaction is to not be calm. Mm-hmm. I have not talked much openly about this since it all happened, so I'm going to try to hold myself together. And she said, "Your dad's had a heart attack. He's not responsive. And they're going to do CPR for the next 30 minutes. And if they can't bring him back," and she just dropped off. She couldn't say anything else. And so I ran and got my wife off the elliptical while I was still talking to her. I made sure that she had somebody on the way to the house to be with her, because I had a 2-hour drive ahead of me to get to her. I took a moment and I just screamed. Yeah. I mean, at the top of my lungs, I just, with everything I had, let out this gut-wrenching cry of just, like, anguish. And then I pulled myself together, and I drove us 2 hours to the town my folks are from. Halfway there, my phone rang, and my mom asked to speak to my wife. And I told her no, because I knew what that call was.
Yeah.
And I said, "You don't have to say it. I know already." Mm-hmm. Because by then, I had kind of assumed that my father was gone. I'm 27 years old. Mm-hmm. That's not something I was ready for. You know, that's not something you're expecting necessarily this young. Even with all the heart disease, even with the surgery, I kept thinking we would have longer. The thing that upsets me the most and breaks my heart is that man busted his ass. He worked for 47 years. Mm-hmm. He retired on Friday evening and passed away in his sleep Friday night.
Yeah.
It was his last day of work. He came home and he just never woke up. He was supposed to start his life with my mom. She was retiring a week later. That was supposed to be, they had plans. That was the thing that rattled me so much, is they had plans and the plans were just gone now.
Yeah.
I lost it. I went off the deep end. I held myself together for about 4 weeks because I felt like that's what I needed to do for my family. And plus, when that happens, you don't have time to think, because within 12 hours, there's family and friends and everyone pouring in the door, and you don't have time to process. And so I spent 4 weeks just going on like nothing happened. I went back home. I started running again. I picked everything up. And then one night I was driving to my in-laws for an NFL playoff game, actually. I had to pull off the interstate and get out of my car because I thought I was having a heart attack. And I had had panic attacks, but I had never had one like that.
You just had so much pressure building up, so much that had just gone wrong. Life had shown you how unfair it can really be.
I still went to the NFL playoff game. Mm-hmm. I tried to hold it together after that, but I finally reached a point where, you know, my wife came home from work one day and I broke down and I told her, "I need help. I need to seek help. I've never sought help for this in my life because society's told me that I'm wrong to seek help, that I'm weak to seek help. But damn it, I need to seek help."
Yeah.
And so I began that process, which has been a long and grueling one. You know, the first med I tried made it worse, and I was having what I called, quote unquote, brain zaps. It felt like somebody was shocking my brain and things would like flash in and out of vision for a second. And like, it really messed with me. And it's a drug that worked great for my parents and worked great for my friends, but for, it's Zoloft. I mean, it's a common drug that people yeah. take all the time. But for me, I had a bad reaction. They tried another SSRI. It shut me down. I finally had to move on to, benzos, which they try not to keep you on for too long because they are habit forming.
Yeah.
That is all that's worked for me. That and yoga and meditation, and I've started therapy, and yeah. I've had to do all these things that I never thought would work for me, but they've been working. Mm-hmm. But I had to reach that point where I couldn't go any further without them in order to seek them out, because I got diagnosed with PTSD after my dad. I still have major depressive disorder. I still deal with chronic panic, and I have mild to moderate agoraphobia. I could not walk to my mailbox for a while without having a massive panic attack and sitting in the middle of the street.
How does agoraphobia work? I just wonder, because I what is the fear exactly? Do you think that, is it just an illogical fear of just walking outside?
I don't know. I'm not a severe agoraphobic, and mine has never been what the doctor called conscious agoraphobia. I have a subconscious or unconscious version of it. I wouldn't even have a fear until I would be in my car and I would be halfway up the street, a mile to the grocery store to pick up eggs or whatever we needed. And halfway up, I would start having a panic attack because that was too far. And so I had to slowly expand my... my circle outside of the house, and that took a while. I'll tell you, when you're going through all this, you start to believe what everyone's telling you. You start to believe that you're a crazy person, because I couldn't rationalize my behavior. I couldn't rationalize the way my body was reacting to things, but it was. I had to reach a point where I realized it was an illness and I wasn't, quote unquote, losing my mind. I just needed professional help. And I mean, agoraphobia and anxiety and wanting to let people know that they're not alone is what birthed the podcast.
Yeah.
I couldn't get a job. I still can't work because the stress of a job has caused me to, I had a job. I lost it after a week.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't handle it. And so, and a lot of people are going to say, you know, suck it up, buttercup. Like you got to contribute to your family. You got to make it happen. But at the end of the day, maybe they think I'm being selfish, but I have to make sure that I'm okay, because yeah. by making sure I'm okay, I am contributing to my family.
I have a friend that she's pretty much paranoid schizophrenic. She had to move back in with her parents, and she tried to get a job. Like her father got her a job running a cash register somewhere. She lasted 2 days before she got into like a verbal altercation with one of the customers. And then she had a panic attack, and it's like, that's what happens. And she's one of the brightest people I know. She's smart as can be. I mean, she's smarter than I am. It's just not working. It's not going to happen. She's got to get healthy first. And then even if she is healthy, she's got to, you know, our society's not quite set up to accommodate.
No. Not at all. I mean, I know the reaction people have. I mean, I watched the HBO documentary that came out, end of last year, the Beware the Slender Man documentary. Mm-hmm. The father of one of the young girls that committed that crime had a kind of poignant quote to me that really resonated with me and helped me understand, because I deal with my mental illnesses, but there are levels of bipolar disorder and schizophrenia and disorders that I can't understand, but I can try to sympathize and empathize. But I never really understood too much of what paranoid schizophrenia can be until he said, you know, the devil's not in the back seat, but the devil's in the back seat and he's talking to you. That's what I think helped me understand that. So I reached out and I told my friend, we have to find a way to have fun, but we've also got to let people know that you're not alone. And just because people don't understand your illness doesn't mean that somebody isn't going through the exact same thing.
Yeah. And that quote was very chilling to hear, because a lot of people will interpret that as, okay, well, anyone that's a paranoid schizophrenic or anyone that has this or that is now a threat. You know, what if that voice tells them to get a gun and shoot people? And I look at that the same way I look at a lot of other things in life, is everyone treats it differently. Everyone has their own experience and everyone's going to react differently to that experience. And I remember there was a story about a guy, like an MMA fighter, who took mushrooms and ended up killing his roommate and like chopping out his heart. Everyone's like, well, see, that's what happens when you're on mushrooms. One guy who probably had issues prior to the mushrooms, and he freaked out. And just like mental illness, might be a terrible comparison, but like, just because somebody has the devil in the backseat talking to them doesn't mean they're going to do what the devil says.
Right. Well, that's the thing, is people hear that and they freak out. People don't understand, or people hear that, yeah, I attempted suicide and I've been suicidal even up until November of last year. I think I told you before we recorded, and I'm happy to tell people now because I'm open about it. Mm-hmm. November of last year, I got in my car to go buy a gun. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a gun guy. You know, I don't have a problem with other people owning guns if they're in a stable mental state, but I got in the car to go buy a gun in a very not stable mental state because I just thought that would be easier just to deal with it that way.
And have you ever been court ordered for therapy?
I've not, no.
And you have a clean background?
I do.
Yeah, you would have been able to buy that gun, no problem.
Exactly. That's a scary thought to me, but it's just people assume that they hear, oh, well, you've thought about suicide, they need to worry about you all the time. Well, no, I'm okay. I'm not a basket case. I'm not somebody you need to handle with kid gloves. I am a human being with an illness. It's, you know, I just have to accommodate myself in ways and handle my illness the way I know how. And people hear that about schizophrenics and they think, oh, well, they're going to go shoot up someplace. Well, let me tell you, anybody could go shoot up someplace at any moment. And maybe they do, maybe they don't have underlying mental illness. I would argue they probably do, and it's just gone untreated. Mm-hmm. But just because somebody's sick doesn't mean that they're going to act that way. And I think people need to destigmatize mental illness in society. And I may be ranting, and I may be pissing a lot of people off because I'm not a professional. And my opinions are just my opinions, but these are the opinions of somebody who has lived for over 10 years with varying levels of mental illness, from minor anxiety all the way up to full-on PTSD and ability to function in society.
Well, it's your story and you're not getting it wrong. That's what I always come back to. If anyone has an issue with any of my guests, I just say it's their story. They don't get it wrong. And
right.
You can disagree with them, but this is what works for them, or this is what they went through. You're still sitting here talking about it. So you're doing something right.
What it boils down to is I just want to live my life in a way that I can help people know you are not alone. There is somebody that's there to listen to you. And if you're considering suicide, you're considering ending your life, please, please, please contact someone. Contact a friend, contact a loved one, contact a suicide hotline. They're totally confidential. You don't even have to be suicidal to call them, by the way. If you just need to talk, they are more than happy to help you. I mean, I'm a big advocate of people using the resources they have, and I'm an advocate for letting people know there are resources, even if that's some goof like me who sits there and plays silly games on the internet with his friends and just tells you, like, hey, you're not alone. Let's talk about this. This is something we live with, and that's why we started the Facebook group we started, for people to come over and be like, hey, I'm so-and-so. I deal with panic disorder too. Here's this funny cat video I found, or here's this funny Star Wars parody I found. But at the same time, the next day, they may post in that group and say, guys, I need to do a mental health check-in. I had a panic attack this morning, or I woke up screaming last night. And it is a safe space for us to go, hey, we hear you, we acknowledge you, and we are here to support you in any way we can. And that was the funniest fucking Star Wars video I have ever seen. Like, it's just our way of being a little family.
When you said you don't have to treat me with kid gloves, I hope that I at least didn't come off as walking on eggshells around you, because I believe that. My friends that have been suicidal in the past and or have a mental illness, I treat them the same way. I mean, if they're having a panic attack, yes, I'm very sensitive to that, but they want normalcy, and I give them that.
Right. And that's the best thing you can do. You know, sometimes if they're having a panic attack, sit with them in silence and just be. Just be there with them.
Yeah.
You know, don't try to fix people who have a mental illness. That's something that I've had to tell myself because I'm a fixer. But my wife has also had to learn, hey, like if I'm having a panic attack, sometimes I just need you to acknowledge, hey, I see what you're going through. I acknowledge you. If you need me, you let me know how I can help you. But if not, I will be over here. And sometimes that's what people need.
You don't have to talk somebody down, but you can talk. You can talk about, well, what did you think of that Star Wars video? You know,
right.
It's not changing the subject out of disrespect or not acknowledging. It's just getting them to focus on something. And
yeah. I had a massive panic attack when my wife left town she was going for a weekend. It was the first time we had been that far apart. She was 3 hours away at the state capitol, and I lost my shit. She had to actually drive back, but I took a couple extra Xanax. She got on the phone with me. I watched silly YouTube comedy videos and talked to her on the phone for 3.5 hours while she drove home.
Yeah.
And it took that long, but I came out of it. And I came out. That's what I needed that time. But, you know, maybe next time I need her to just let me have the room and be to myself.
Yeah.
Just really being there for people and not necessarily trying to go, hey, you're broken. Let me fix you.
Yeah. There's no logic. There's no rhyme or reason. It's just... It
right.
Just is.
Dude, I wish there was rhyme or reason.
Yeah. If A, then B.
There was,
yeah,
a solution. I wish there was a pill. You know, medication isn't for everybody. It's worked wonders for me, but it's not for everybody. Some people don't respond well to it. As I've shown, I didn't respond well to some medications. But at the end of the day, like, I wish there was just a magic pill that I could take and, oh, your depression's cured, your panic disorder's cured, your all this is gone, and you are a quote-unquote normal human being. But the more you talk to people and the more you realize a staggering amount of people deal with mental illness, there is no normal. Everybody is just who they are. There's no one way to be.
Well, Steven, you come off as a very charming, likable dude. And
well, I hope so.
And the fact that you started a podcast where you bring these things to light, I'm glad that I've got to meet you, even if it's virtually.
But, virtually counts.
But if anything, just know, if you don't hear this from anyone else, I appreciate you. And I am happy as hell that I was able to meet you and that you didn't go through with it. You know?
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. I am happy to have met you too. I'm happy to be standing here, or sitting here, I guess, at my desk. But
yeah,
I'm happy to still be here and still fighting.
Yeah, that's what it's about.
It's tough talk sometimes, but you know, it's about the fight, and it's about, dude, I'm such a hippy dippy. Like, it's all love. Like, everybody take care of each other. Like I'm such a little hippy dippy. I'm sorry.
No. If you're a hippy dippy, then you're a peaceful warrior. Then, yeah.
Well, there you go.
Since I spoke to Steven on this episode, we've communicated a few times online through social media, and he's just a wonderful person. I got a little choked up at the end of the episode because, like all my guests, I get to know you and I get to see you and see your pain, and it hurt me so much to hear his story. I guess that answers the question. I'm human too, and I do have feelings, and sometimes I can only hear so much before it really gets to me also.